Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our program this evening, A Gala for Liberty, with the presentation of the Alexis de Tocqueville Awards, which, as many of you know, are named for the 19th century political philosopher and author of the famous book, Democracy in America. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. We're delighted to have you join with us tonight, and I hope that you will really enjoy our program this evening. For those of you who are new to the Independent Institute, the Institute is a nonprofit public policy research organization that sponsors in-depth studies of major social and economic issues. The results are published as books and other publications and form the basis of numerous conference and media programs. More than 20 years ago, we founded the Institute to examine the actual nature and consequences of government policy. But instead of succumbing to the popular or political biases, trends, phobias, narcissism, or moral ambiguities, we are ever mindful that truth, goodness, justice, and liberty are not illusions. Indeed, there are certain non-negotiable presuppositions upon which human inquiry and science, the rule of law, and free civilization rest. We seek to explore such matters and address important questions that might otherwise be ignored, including ones normally considered out of the box or controversial or politically incorrect, but which we believe may likely be not just crucial to our understanding, but enable us to get to real answers and long-lasting solutions. As a result, the Institute was founded to cut through the noise and spin of special interest public policy debate in the U.S. and elsewhere. In order to do so, we had to establish a new kind of institute, one of a kind, frankly, in the public policy field, which, as many of you know, is dominated by partisan advocacy groups of virtually every stripe imaginable. In our case, without the financial backing of any interest group, we became the first garage think tank. And 20 years later, we operate with more than 140 research fellows in the U.S. and around the world. So we invite you to get to know us better. We hope that you'll enjoy getting beyond the stereotypes of left and right into the realm of innovative, bold ideas, and we believe that such ideas are the key to a brighter future. In your gift bag, for example, you'll find the copy of a new book from us, edited by our senior fellow Alvaro Vargas Llosa, entitled Lessons from the Poor, that chronicles enterprise-based, entrepreneurial-based success stories in uplifting people out of abject poverty in Latin America and Africa, despite rampant corruption and government barriers of all sorts. You'll also find a copy of our quarterly journal, The Independent Review, and other information about our program. In the course of our work, we also take special interest in recognizing individuals whose contributions are so unusual, so noteworthy, and so effective that we believe they merit special attention. And tonight's honorees are exemplary in this regard. However, before we begin, I want to note that in making tonight's dinner possible, the assistance of many wonderful people was critical. First of all, we're privileged to have had five world-renowned figures who have graced us as honorary co-chairs: Jihan El-Sadat, the Dalai Lama, Lord Brian Griffiths, Vaclav Klaus, and Muhammad Yunus. The dinner committee was co-chaired by six distinguished business leaders, who I also want to sincerely thank: Bob Alspaugh, retired CEO of KPMG International; Tim Draper, founding and managing director of Draper Fisher Jurvetson Associates; Bob Galvin, chairman emeritus of Motorola; Mike Moe, co-founder and former chairman and CEO of ThinkPenMuir; Bill Rutter, chairman of Synergetics; and Lisa Stevens, regional president of Wells Fargo Bank. I also want to thank the many members of the dinner committee, each of whose participation really helped form the basis for tonight's program. And I also want to thank the people at Kendall Jackson Vineyard Estates and Freemark Abbey Winery, who have very generously provided the superb wines for tonight's dinner, which we'll be enjoying. And in this regard, I want to express our special gratitude to our friend John Bryan. I also want to thank Hugasian Flowers that provided the beautiful flower table centerpieces. See's Candies deserves our special thanks for generous donations of the fine chocolate confections. I also especially want to thank the John Santos Sextet. Weren't they just sensational? I mean, really. I also want to thank our friends at the Exploratorium, our good friend Janine Vaughn, and videographer Jean Lanzaga. But most especially, I want to thank Juliana Jelinek for overseeing our entire gala enterprise. If she would please stand. And also the team that she headed up, including Joseph Asbell and Abby Shepherd, if they would stand. In fact, if the entire Institute staff could stand, because they're all deeply involved in the project. I would also like to introduce a number of the Institute's board members who are with us tonight. And if you would please stand. Gil Collins, Peter Howley, Isabel Speakman Johnson, Dieter Tate, and Mary Thoreau. We're very grateful to you all. Before I leave you to enjoy the rest of your first course, I want to refer you in your printed dinner program for tonight's schedule, which is divided into three segments or courses. Each course is dedicated to one of our honorees. We will break between courses or segments as well will be shown on the screens that you see above. We also have question cards on each table for your use in submitting questions. Those of you with questions are asked to please have them ready to be picked up before the dessert course, and we'll have people circling during that time to pick up your cards. At this point, I'd like to introduce my good friend, Reverend Alan Jones, Dean of Grace Cathedral, who will kindly lead us in the invocation.
Let us pray. Dear God, we thank you that you have planted in the human heart the longing for liberty. We thank you that you have shaped us for freedom, and of course to rise up among us champions of the human spirit. Help us to discern liberty's gift and freedom's burden by our understanding that no one is fully free while others are enslaved. No one enjoys the privileges of liberty without taking on its responsibilities. And these privileges push us to ensure that every member of the human family is truly free. We thank you for the power of this vision, which has inflamed the hearts of courageous men and women throughout the ages down to our own day, freedom fighters, artists, imaginative philanthropists, and lonely visionaries. As we seek to embody the four classic freedoms, freedom from want, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from fear, give us that fifth and greatest freedom of all, the freedom of knowing that what we choose to do is in conformity with our inalienable dignity as human beings, that our freedom may not be squandered on the trivial, but placed in the service of the common good. We ask for courage to fight for freedom and stand for liberty in challenging times, even as vast, impoverished, and rapidly expanding populations, whose ways and values are only dimly understood, press up against our rich and seemingly ordered society. We affirm that the future may be germinating today, not in a boardroom in London, or an office in Washington, or in a bank in Tokyo or Beijing, but in some remote outpost or other, a kindly British orphanage in the grim foothills of Peru, a house for the dying in a back street of Calcutta, an easygoing French medical team at the starving edge of the desert, a mission to Somalia by Irish social workers who remember their own great hunger, a nursery program to assist convict mothers at a New York prison, in some unheralded corner where great-hearted human beings are committed to loving in an extraordinary way, and in their very being are the bearers of liberty. May it be so. Amen.
Thank you, Alan, and bon appetit. Our first honoree is William K. Bowes, Jr. Bill is the founding partner of U.S. Venture Partners and has labored for decades as an investment pioneer, venture capitalist, an entrepreneur's entrepreneur, a philanthropist, and much more. We'd like to share a short video about this truly exceptional man. I want to thank the Exploratorium for helping us in that regard.
They used to call him U2 before he got married. He was lived in an apartment with some people. And he knew everything, but he didn't say anything. And they said he was like the U2, just circling over and gathering information. That's sort of Bill. You have no idea how much he knows about everything, because he's not going to tell you.
When Bill has something to say, it's a very good idea to listen. And he won't use a lot of words to say it. And I think people do listen. He has a gravitas that's impressive.
No, I knew his parents pretty well, and they were both gentlemanly and gentlewomanly people. My mother was a doctor. His dad was an investor in a number of projects. Very quiet-spoken people. Probably Bill got his self-confidence from being loved and respected as a kid. Most prominent quality of Bill is honesty and integrity. There's lots of other fine qualities, but that one runs through everything he does and all his behavior. Along with that, he has a very keen intelligence, so that he sees things in depth and can analyze situations and sometimes in a few words sum up some situation that makes us all understand it better.
He's definitely a risk taker. You can't be in the venture capital business and be as successful as Bill is without taking huge risks. It means you have to start companies from ground zero. And those companies don't always work out well for all of us, including Bill.
I think Bill could spot, with a lot of skill, a situation that wasn't an existing company. Some people with an idea, some technology in a marketplace that they could serve. Bill had a really good way of not only positioning himself to hear about those opportunities, but to picture what that could look like when made into a business.
The one thing about Bill is that's amazing is that he is probably, in my view, one of the very, very top venture capitalists in the Valley, and he's probably the most humble of all of them. And that's just the mark of just a true, true person, a mensch.
What motivates Bill to achieve
the game, the intellectual game?
Yeah, learning.
Yeah.
It's not about anything material. He couldn't care less. I mean, definitely couldn't care less.
I'm sure that when he thinks about Amgen, far from his mind is the financial success. I think what he looks at is what this company has been able to do for people. We've treated now over 9 million people around the world with medicine, and these are people with really serious illness, some of whom, maybe even many of whom, wouldn't be alive without our medicines. They certainly wouldn't have the quality of life.
I think his contribution is that he seeds, you know, it doesn't stop just with Bill. He seeds it through other people to continue the legacy, to keep learning, to keep funding good ideas. So it doesn't, he's the germinator.
He has been very interested in health and health-related issues, so that he knew how to bear down on, to find places and bear down on them that were providing key cures or key alleviation of human suffering. He has courage. He never thought about, would somebody not like it? Would somebody call him not conservative? Or would somebody call him liberal? That doesn't enter his mind. That kind of stuff doesn't interest Bill. He likes to take positions on things that he believes will decrease human suffering, increase human liberty.
We can't talk about Bill without talking about Uda. And those two guys as a couple are unique. Their appetite for life, for adventure, for helping other people is unmatched in my experience.
He's been very involved in the lives of a lot of younger people, either educating them, backing them, nurturing them. And I think that for him, it's just a joy to watch people succeed through his influence.
When Bill gets an award, particularly an award that has this much elaborate preparation, he will be amused and he'll be pleased and he'll be happy about it in his own way, a quiet way.
I think that those of us who had a chance to help make this video are really honored that we were chosen, because it gives us a chance to say some things we'd never say to Bill personally. He's a wonderful friend, a very, very fine human being, and I really love the opportunity to say so in public.
Few can better discuss the significance of Bill Bowes and his work than our next speaker. Michael Boskin is the Tully Friedman Professor of Economics and Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Michael's the author of more than 100 books and scholarly articles. He received his PhD here in the Bay Area in economics at UC Berkeley, my alma mater. Good choice. Sorry, the Stanford. And he is the recipient of numerous awards, including the Adam Smith Prize. Michael Boskin.
Thank you very much, David. And before I begin my remarks about Bill, let me just congratulate you and the Independent Institute on all the important things you do. Liberty is not something to be taken lightly. We've all had experiences in our lifetime, many of us of my generation and younger, much fewer than people of Bill's generation and older, about what the sacrifices people have had to make for that liberty for America and around the world, and that is being repeated around the world now in a variety of places. And you'll hear a lot more about that as we progress through the evening. But again, congratulations, David, and thank all of you for being here to support the Institute. It's important for me to start off by saying that I usually demur when I'm asked to do these sorts of introductions or comments. I've had the opportunity to do many in my lifetime, and having been there and done that, I usually say no. Perhaps the most memorable in a list that includes some presidents and Fed chairmen and CEOs was that I once inadvertently had to introduce Dr. Ruth. But that's a story for another day. But when David asked me to introduce William K. Bowes Jr., Bill to us, on the occasion of being awarded the Alexis de Tocqueville Award by the Independent Institute, I immediately and happily agreed, especially since Bill is being honored not just for his important work in business entrepreneurship and science, which we've heard a little bit about and I'll remark on briefly, but also for utilizing market-based approaches to greatly enhance the welfare of people in the United States and worldwide, demonstrating that there's a role for government, but there's a lot of good that can come from market-based solutions to people's problems. Bill, as we heard in the video, in which almost every remark I'm going to make was presaged or said by those friends of ours, he's not only a tremendously successful venture capitalist and businessman, he's a remarkable human being. No, make that beyond remarkable. And for all his amazing achievements, some of which you heard, Bill remains humble and down to earth. He's the last person who would seek praise, let alone revel in it. In fact, he's undoubtedly uncomfortable right now, but Bill, you'll just have to grin and bear it, for you more than deserve it. I've known Bill for many years. He was a founder of one of America's most prominent and successful venture capital firms, U.S. Venture Partners, where he and his colleagues brought real-world business experience and ideas, as well as the capital, to the entrepreneurs they funded. He was a founding shareholder of Amgen, and the Amgen participant in that video perhaps didn't do Amgen enough credit. It's one of the world's most important biotech firms. And Bill helped create not just a fabulous investment, but a firm that helps millions of people worldwide fight cancer, kidney disease, rheumatoid arthritis, and other disabling diseases. Bill and Uda are remarkable philanthropists, bringing that business acumen, that intelligence, that scientific knowledge to such important institutions as the Exploratorium, where he recently stepped down as board chairman, the Asian Art Museum, Grace Cathedral, the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and the UCSF Foundation, where he was chairman of the really important Mission Bay Capital campaign that has proved to be such a success. Now, I have to start by saying, I have to first intrude here, that Bill had the best early training imaginable, preparing him for this beyond remarkable career. He has a BA in economics from Stanford. He served in the Army infantry in the South Pacific and Japan during and after World War II, and I'll reluctantly add his MBA from Harvard, where he serves on the visiting committee of the Harvard Business School. Now, we all have to be grateful for, you know, the forks we took in the road and the ones not taken. Bill's early career was at Blythe Eastman Dillon, where he worked for about a quarter century. They merged with Payne Weber, now part of the Union Bank of Switzerland, known as UBS. And given the current, up to the minute, state of major financial institutions, let's pause for a moment and give thanks for the path Bill did not take. Then again, if Bill had stayed on, maybe they wouldn't be in such trouble. A famous poet once said, T.S. Eliot to be precise, "The end of our exploration will be to arrive where we started from and to know the place for the first time." Bill has come full circle. I don't know whether this makes him a glutton for punishment or whether what goes around necessarily comes around, but Bill now also serves on the board of the Hoover Institution and oversees a dozen Stanford economists. I don't know if any of them ever taught Bill back when he was an undergraduate. I doubt it. I know Bill best as a friend and Bohemian Club campmate. It was the membership of Bill and some other remarkable men of what's been called the greatest generation, some of which are here tonight, some of which you've heard from, that enticed me to join Hillbilly's camp. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made. How lucky I've been to share, not enough, but to share their friendship over the years and to learn from the example Bill and these others have set in their careers and personal lives of living a life well and full and giving so much back to their friends and families, their communities, our nation, and indeed the world. Let me conclude for a moment by sharing some insights into the man Bill Bowes, in addition to what you heard in the video. Coming from academe, I'm used to people having a strong opinion on everything and letting you know it all the time, whether or not they know anything about what they're talking about. Wind a professor up and you get a 50-minute lecture about any subject. Bill's cut from a different cloth. He doesn't demand to weigh in on every single issue. He's a good listener. He chooses his spots. He's neither loud nor bellicose, always soft-spoken, but as has already been said, when he does speak, people listen. and they listen carefully. He's always insightful, sometimes profound, much like de Tocqueville on Democracy in America. Always thoughtful, always careful, always a gentleman. And because of all that, he is supremely effective. Unless I end on too serious a note, when I think of Bill, the image that first comes to mind, in current vernacular, his homepage in my mind, is always that big grin, that gentle smile, that great laugh. That's another lesson Bill teaches by example. Relax, have some fun. You don't have to take everything so seriously all the time. There's plenty of time for the serious, but also time to have some fun along the way. And that's how we should think about Bill receiving this wonderful award, an interim recognition along the way, a midterm grade. For there are many good deeds still up Bill's sleeve, many great ideas percolating in his head, and many, many, many good times yet to share. So, Bill, would you come up?
Bill, you've been a friend and an inspiration to us and to many people, more than I think any of us can count. And we want to sincerely thank you for all of your work. And to express our gratitude, I want to take this opportunity to present you with our Alexis de Tocqueville Award. It's a small award. It can never duplicate the weight of what you've accomplished. And we're just very grateful and honored to have the privilege of making this award to you. Thank you very much.
Microphone's on you.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you, Michael. I was hoping that my wife heard all those nice words you said. She looked pretty surprised. I guess the key to what I've been able to accomplish is it lies in the world of entrepreneurship. Everybody knows about Silicon Valley and changing the way the industrial scene looks. But there's another part of entrepreneurship, which is social entrepreneurship. I spent the last 15 years or so in that field. Social entrepreneurship, making something from nothing. Something from nothing, I think, defines entrepreneurship. And for instance, a few years ago, a woman in New York decided that there should be a initiative providing mini grants and mentoring to starving artists. Simple. Today, this year, 300 starving artists will be getting mini grants and mentoring, and more to come. A few years ago, a woman in New Jersey decided that our school system would be well served by encouraging promising college graduates to spend 2 years in tough schools. This year, 3,000 of those college graduates will be spending time, 2 years at least, in tough schools. The performance in the schools has gone up measurably when these students are teaching. And what's really encouraging is that 2/3 of these students stay on in teaching. They don't go back to industry. And they go on to become principals and on school boards and so forth. A few years ago, a retired executive from a big Silicon Valley company decided to devote the next 25 years of his life to early detection of cancer. Right now, it's a thriving enterprise with collaborations nationwide partnerships with great scientific universities, and I'm sure that they're going to help us detect cancer early. If you catch it early, it's 90% curable, maybe more. A few years ago, a dean of a department of biology in a very prestigious research institution decided that he couldn't move his field fast enough inside of academia. So he went outside of academia and started an institute, which is pushing the next generation of medicine. And he's moving much faster, I think, than he would have staying where he was. These are the kinds of things that I try to dig out and support. And it's really fun, and I commend it to any of you who are in the position to do so. It's more fun than golf, and it's more fun than toys. So I thank you, David, and I thank you, Michael, for being so kind, and particularly David for choosing me for this award. It's a true honor, and I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you again, Bill, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I will now enjoy our main course. Our next honoree, Andy Garcia, is the Academy Award-nominated Cuban-born actor, director, and producer, whose 38 films include The Godfather Part III, The Untouchables, When a Man Loves a Woman, Ocean's 11, and many others. But a special note this evening are his films set in Cuba against the turbulent background of corruption, revolution, and tyranny. Featuring powerful stories and fabulous music, each film portrays the lives, loves, and struggles of the Cuban people from the perspective of individuals in the musical arts, seeking beauty and joy while facing corruption, oppression, subterfuge, and mass murder. Here now are some segments from his films, The Lost City, and For Lover Country, the Arturo Sandoval story.
We intend to pass a resolution that will remove Batista through the constitutional process.
Senator Cosío has asked me to prepare a speech for him.
This is the opening statement.
I've made reference to Seneca. Read it aloud, Senator, so we can hear how it sounds.
Okay.
Please.
Mr. Speaker, I must protest as Seneca did in ancient Rome of the violence of office. Today, we, the citizens of Cuba, are being persecuted by a tyrant and his reign of terror, meted out to our population by his police, and especially by a certain colonel in the force whose name has become synonymous with sudden death. Seneca was persecuted by two tyrants, Caligula and Nero. In spite of that, Seneca advocated a return to the Republic. I'm afraid, Mr. Speaker, Seneca, not the Neros of this world, should be an example to us.
How many more do you
have? Recoge eso. Feyobe, let's move. Don't waste any time with that. Let's move.
You seem troubled, Feyobe. Is it about the captain we shot?
Listen to me very carefully. In an insurrection, the end justifies the means. What is an insurrection? Huh? Armed struggle. What is the end? Revolution, which entails social, economic, and political transformations. Like I said, the end justifies the means.
Stop the music! Stop the music! Stop that music!
Who are you?
I am Soraya Munoz, a delegate for the Musicians Union.
But what authority do you have to come here and stop my rehearsal?
The government gave me the authority. See, you own this beautiful cabaret, but we own the orchestra.
Really?
Really. If I tell the orchestra not to play, they can't play.
Is that so?
Fico, we're in the union. They control the union.
I see. And on what grounds do you have to come in here and stop my show?
You just can't use the saxophone in the orchestra anymore.
Come again?
The saxophone is an instrument of the imperialists.
The saxophone was invented by a man named Sax in Belgium.
Do you know what the Belgium imperialists are doing in the Congo? They're a bunch of murderers.
You don't say.
No, I do say. And I am saying that if you want the orchestra to play, then you have to go without the saxophone. Otherwise, I will stop the show.
You're always taking a risk because in Cuba, you never know where the line is. You can play Gershwin once too often.
Not being able to play Gershwin does not constitute persecution.
It is if someone decides that it's counter-revolutionary and they come and they put you in jail. Because in Cuba, you live with that fear every day that someone might come to you, to your house, to your family, and hurt you because of a song. Just a song. And that is persecution.
What are you listening to?
This is Atmosphere. Dizzy Gillespie. Charlie Parker, live at Carnegie Hall, 1947, side B, track 2.
You know what I mean.
It's just music. Great music.
You're not supposed to listen to that station.
Now we're safe.
It's not funny. You could get in trouble.
Believe me, I know. I spent 4 months in military jail for listening to that.
He's throwing his life away. My father used to be a great mechanic. And they came and they took his garage away.
Keep your voice down.
What are you afraid of? The revolution? Remember, it gives us everything.
They didn't take your father's garage. He gave it up.
They nationalized it! They took away what he believed in. They took away his dream, his love, his trade, the thing that he did.
We all made sacrifices, Arturo.
For what?
For what? For the country. For an ideal. Free hospitals, free education.
Sure, of course.
And by the way, those 100,000 people running away at Mariel, they are giving up.
Giving up?
Yes!
That is exactly what they are not doing. And by the way, what good is free education if you can't read what you want, if you can't say what you want? What good are eyes if everybody is blind?
Why do you think the Cuban government is so afraid of your music?
They're not afraid of my music. They're afraid of ideas.
Oh, come on. Fidel Castro is afraid of your ideas?
Fidel Castro is afraid of any idea that's not his. You know how he overthrew Batista?
I know it was a popular revolution.
It was a popular idea. It was a great idea. He promised the Cuban people what they were desperate for. Restoration of a constitution, democracy, freedom from a dictatorship. And he did it with 80 people and 50 guns and a boat that almost sank because somebody left the toilet running.
Well, that can't be all they had.
That's all he needed because the idea gave him the strength of an army.
Our next speaker has witnessed repression firsthand in his own country, and I'm delighted to introduce him to speak about our second honoree. Alvaro Vargas Llosa is Senior Fellow and Director of the Center on Global Prosperity at the Independent Institute. Alvaro's weekly column is nationally syndicated by the Washington Post Writers Group, and his many books include Liberty for Latin America, The Che Guevara Myth, and Lessons from the Poor, which I've already mentioned you have a copy. Last year, he was named Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum, and he's currently completing the four-part National Geographic documentary on Latin America entitled Consequences. Alvaro?
Thank you, David. When I told my wife I was going to be sitting next to Andy Garcia and introducing him, she said, I need two autographs. And I said, why? You've never asked me for even one autograph. She said, I need a replacement in case I lose the other one. So you can imagine I am approaching this introduction with a deep sense of humiliation tonight. A few years ago, I was living in London, where one of my best friends was Cuban novelist Guillermo Cabrera Infante, the author of acclaimed books such as Three Trapped Tigers and Infante's Inferno. Guillermo had three passions: literature, his wife Miriam, and Cuba, his country of origin, which he had left for political reasons many decades earlier, and where his books were banned and his name was unspeakable. Every couple of weeks or so, I would visit him in his house on Gloucester Road in South Kensington, where Miriam, Guillermo, and I, surrounded by stacks of books, VHS videos, and old records, invariably spent hours talking about Cuba. On almost every occasion, he would bring up the Lost City, a two-decade-old project on which he had been working to no avail. It had proved impossible to raise the capital necessary to produce a movie about Cuba in the 1950s, seen through the eyes of a family torn, as every Cuban family at the time, by revolution. A revolution that would end up as the god Saturn devouring its own children. He had an ally in that quixotic enterprise, whose name invariably came up in the conversation: Andy Garcia. The actor's passion for the project was no less ardent than Guillermo's. In a stroke of poetic justice, Andy Garcia was finally able to put together the funds when Guillermo, frail and worn out, began to get very sick. My dear friend was able to see the movie, whose screenplay he co-wrote with Andy Garcia, just before he died. The film was produced in association with the actor's production company, Cinesound Productions, and Andy Garcia composed the original score and produced the soundtrack. As many of you know, The Lost City tells the story of Fico, a nightclub owner in revolutionary Cuba, a country under a vicious right-wing dictatorship in which there was a high standard of living, by Latin American standards at least, and a vibrant culture. But there was also a profound dissatisfaction with the corrupt political environment. The old regime was soon replaced with a tyranny that half a century later is still in place. Every aspect of that tragic story is captured in the film. Families ripped apart by force masquerading as idealism, acts of inconceivable personal cruelty, the obliteration of individual liberty, and the uprooting of millions of people from their land. And we see the intoxicating music of Benny Moré and the energy of rhythms such as mambo, cha-cha-cha, and rumba ceding their place to the rigidity and paralysis of censorship and fear. What was particularly moving about that film was the fact that a Hollywood actor who did not need to risk his reputation by undertaking a project certain to ruffle feathers in an industry that still sees Fidel Castro as a romantic revolutionary and Che Guevara as a modern-day Robin Hood, dared to co-write, direct, and act in it at all. It was an act of courage and justice. The movie reminds us of the roots of the Cuban tragedy, namely the utter inadequacy of the country's institutions and elites, which eventually crystallized in the communist dictatorship. Cuba's independence could have produced a successful republic, partly due to the local political culture and foreign obstacles placed on their ability to exercise self-responsibility, Cubans failed to substitute the rule of law for violence during the half century between the day when they obtained their independence and the time of Castro's triumph. The conservative movement that opposed independence never developed into a force for stable institutions, nor did the liberals who stood for an independent republic, civil rights, and upward social mobility evolve into anything comparable to the United States Republican founders. Perhaps if Spain had not limited political rights after the 10-year war from 1868 to 1878, the Liberal Party would have been worthy of the name. Perhaps if the United States had not tied the political hands of the early Cuban Republic leaders, many of them capable of replacing the extraordinary José Martí, who organized the 1895 revolution, would have emerged, marginalizing the aspiring despots. But ultimately, it was the Machados, the Batistas, and the Castros who prevailed. Like so many Cubans in the United States, or in Europe for that matter, Andy Garcia's defense of his home country's freedom has put him at odds with a good part of the intellectual and cultural establishment. Unwilling to settle for the comfortable stereotypes of bien-pensant pseudo-liberals who love to project their thirst of the exotic on Cuba, Andy Garcia, who left the island with his family in 1961 when he was only 5 years old, knows, as one critic who defended him put it, that in Cuba, inner tubes were used in truck tires, oil drums for oil, and styrofoam for insulation, and today they are used as flotation devices to flee the glorious liberation while fighting off hammerheads and tiger sharks on their way to the Florida Keys. Like hundreds of thousands of Cubans, Andy Garcia moved to the United States not because his family wanted to, but because they had to. And they prospered in this country. His father was able to build a cosmetics business while suffering the indignity of seeing many American politicians, writers, and activists celebrating the regime that expelled his mother, an English teacher, his father, a landowner and attorney, his brother and himself from the land of their ancestors. As he himself likes to say, Andy Garcia decided to become an actor after he contracted mononucleosis and gave up his athletic aspirations. He started to act while at Florida International University. From there, he went to Hollywood, where after working as a waiter, he got his break in the TV series Hill Street Blues after a casting agent saw him perform in an improvisational group at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles. That was followed by his roles in Blue Skies Again, The Mean Season, and 8 Million Ways to Die, which in turn led to the part that turned him into a star, Agent George Stone in The Untouchables. In 1990, his reputation achieved new heights when he played the unforgettable Vincent Corleone, the grandson of Vito Corleone in The Godfather Part 3. But his film career, which landed him a dizzying succession of major roles over the years in movies such as Internal Affairs, When a Man Loves a Woman, Night Falls on Manhattan, and the Ocean's 11, 12, and 13 series, never weakened his loyalty to Cuba and his defense of human rights. The idea of human rights is one that has become very confusing in modern times because it has come to mean many things to different people, and power politics and statist ideologies manipulated to fit their goals. There's a big debate about the origin of human rights, but whether we trace their roots back to Urukagina's code in a Sumerian city-state more than 4,000 years ago, to Cyrus's cylinder 2,500 years ago, to Magna Carta, to the United States Declaration of Independence, or even William Lloyd Garrison, who might have been the first to use the exact phrase, all of us in this room know exactly what we mean by human rights, and so does Andy Garcia, who has denounced the oppression of the Cuban people time and again. But there are other ways in which he has stood for human rights. One of them is the rescue of his country's cultural heritage against the Cuban government's efforts to replace it with its own fraudulent version. As one of the most famous and beloved members of the Miami community, a much misunderstood community that is as pluralistic, tolerant, free-spirited, and jovial as any in the United States, even if it does have its share of crazies, and I have lived there, Andy Garcia has paid homage to his fatherland's artistic legacy in movies such as Cachao, like his rhythm, There Is No Other, a tribute to legendary mambo composer Israel Cachao Lopez that marked his directorial debut, or Love for Love of Country, the Arturo Sandoval story, the tale of the acclaimed jazz musician who fled Cuba in order to pursue his career, a movie whose score and soundtrack he also produced. His record label has put out outstanding Cuban music, some of which he performs himself. Andy Garcia spends time in Miami, mostly summers, and is married to a Cuban, Maria Victoria, with whom he has four children. He embodies that nostalgia of the lost city that is the hallmark of the Cuban exile community, a sentiment so powerful that it is transmitted from generation to generation, and transmitted in such a way that even a five-year-old boy with no personal recollection of where he was born grew up to make it his. It constitutes a creative longing for what is no longer, strictly speaking, a real Cuba, but one made of memory and imagination, which makes it perhaps even more real. There is, of course, no way of bringing back to life the more than 10,000 Cubans who, according to Cuba Archive, have perished under Castro through executions or imprisonment, or the many more who never made it to the Florida Keys. According to various estimates, one in four rafters never makes it. And there is no way to give back to those whose lives were spent in the moral and material wasteland of the tyranny, their lost years. But people like tonight's honoree also remind us that there are things that no totalitarian system can take away from the people over whom it lords. Their love of freedom is one of them. Andy Garcia does all of this with elegance and respect for his fans. Unlike so many Hollywood stars who parade their private lives in frivolous ways, he protects his family from the prying eyes of the media. We must thank him for defying the modern cult of gossip that turns moral and intellectual hierarchies upside down to make what is secondary all important and demean what really matters. In doing so, he reminds us of the treasure that is each person's personal realm. We don't know when Andy Garcia will be able to go back to the country from which he was taken away, or when his countrymen and women will be able to watch his movies, including The Lost City. But one thing is certain. No matter how much more time passes until that is possible, one day his fellow Cubans on the island will be thankful for all that he has done for them and for what is yet to come, including the films he recently completed, City Island and New York, I Love You. He has won many awards as an actor, director, and producer, including a Golden Globe and an Academy Award nomination, the Harvard University Foundation Award, 3 ALMA Awards, 2 Imogen Awards, and the inclusion of his star in the Walk of Fame. But tonight, we want to thank him for his devotion to liberty, for being that rare combination of the cinematographic imagination and civic virtue, and for the inestimable way in which he has preserved the artistic heritage of which he himself is a stalwart heir. The Independent Institute is proud to add to the list of honors with which his career has blessed him by distinguishing him with the Alexis de Tocqueville Award for being a champion of liberty and human rights. Thank you.
Andy, you've devoted your life, as Alvaro's pointed out, to excellence in film and music and far more. And you've gone far further in courageously using your talent and public stature to boldly champion civil and economic liberties and overcome the plight of the Cuban people under communism and any form of tyranny. And to express our gratitude, I want to present you with the Alexis de Tocqueville Award. It's an honor and privilege to have all of our honorees with us this evening. and an honor to be able to provide this kind of recognition, which again only touches and scratches the surface of what we owe to them. So thank you.
Thank you very much. It's very difficult to follow such eloquent words from a great writer that I respect deeply, Mr. Vargas Llosa, who comes from a great tradition, as we all know, of writers, and also of a family that has stood up against tyranny and the lack of freedoms around the world, including, you know, Mario and Alvaro. There was, I guess, only one thing that I found maybe slightly inaccurate in terms of what Alvaro says. When I left Cuba when I was five and a half, it's about 2 years after the Castro's takeover of the country, I left with many memories. And I think that because for some reason, once someone immigrates, or in our case, are exiled into a country, and you begin to realize, at first I thought we were just going on a vacation. It was presented to me as we're going to Miami. I thought it was just a trip. You know, I'd never obviously been outside of Cuba, but it seemed like we were just going on a trip. That once it became a reality in my mind as a young man that we weren't going back, I think that you begin to protect those memories and those images. But in a way, I was fortunate, even though I had not left the country that I cherished so much, and I was able to come here. Maybe I should start again. I should leave and then. Because the reality is, sorry. The reality is, this country afforded me everything that had been taken away from me. When I was about five, my father came home. By then, all the properties had been, you know, been nationalized. This is 1961 and a half. And Castro had betrayed all his promises of the restoration of the Constitution and elections and all the things that supposedly were part of the manifesto of the anti-Batista rebellion, and had solidified power and declared himself a Marxist, or as we now know, that's more of a Fidelista than anything else. But he passed a law which you gave up the rights of your children to the state, and for state education, which quickly turned into indoctrination, and a very young, I think it was 12 years old, military obligation. And my father came home, and my mother said to him, "I saw your son marching and singing the Internationale," which is a great irony because throughout this time, Cuba was constantly, Castro was having sort of diatribes about, you know, anti-American imperialism and Yankee see, you know, Yankee, Cuba see, Yankee no, and American influences over Cuba, and yet through the back door, he was letting Russian imperialism walk right in and take over the country. And I was marching, she caught me marching and singing and humming the Internationale at the age of five, and I hadn't even been in school yet. And shortly thereafter, we gathered the family, we came first, my father followed. he was involved in the Peter Pan project, which some of those of you don't know, Peter Pan is an organization through Monsignor Waltz in Miami that parents of Cuban children who could not leave the country were sending their children ahead through the Catholic Church to foster homes in America, hoping that they could reunite with them. Some did, some never saw their children again, but they did not want their children to grow up under that system. So my father stayed behind because he was one of the lawyers who was helping and at times falsifying visas to get children out of the country. And he sent us ahead and then eventually came on a flight, on a Peter Pan flight. He brought two children on the flight and asked the pilot, who was a friend of his, to save him a seat. And under the pretext of walking the children onto the flight, he stayed on the plane and came. So I am, I guess, the beneficiary of America's great generosity and all the things that that we were deprived in Cuba and the sacrifices that my father and mother made for me to have this opportunity. So I cannot take credit for anything I've done. Because I believe it's the system that creates and gives the opportunities for those who dream, that slowly, one step at a time, you can achieve those dreams. And I go around the world, and I'm constantly asked about Cuba. And the one thing that not only frustrates me, but continually fascinates me in a way, because people have a perception of Cuba that is based on the very propaganda that the Castro regime has been putting out for the past 50 years. And when you try to simply explain to them what the system is about and what's going on, they go, "Really? I didn't know that." And as we all know, over the years, there's been an extraordinary support and a blind eye that's turned towards that regime and the atrocities of that regime. And there are problems all over the world, as we all know. And I don't say that Cuba's problems are greater than things that have been going on all over the world in Africa for decades and much longer than even in Cuba. But the reality is, for some reason, that Cuba and that regime gets, you know, they catch a break, you know. They seem to permit that. They seem to celebrate the fact that he stands up against America, and that is a popular enough cause for them to look and turn a blind eye to all the things that he does. And it's a very frustrating thing, because those of us who know the reality of what's going on in Cuba, it's a very painful reality in which I live in. The movie The Lost City, which is, for me, was just I looked at it as a movie that had all the classical elements of all the great films that I grew up with. You know, a time of dramatic historical transition, music, dance, conflicts within a family, impossible love as a central metaphor. You can love her, but you can't be with her. And these are the makings of movies like Dr. Zhivago and a lot of the great movies that dealt with that. But for some reason, my movie became sort of like the most difficult thing for anybody to embrace. For 16 years, not one studio in the United States would embrace the idea of giving any money to distribute the movie. Even at the peak of whatever popularity I have been able to achieve in my life, at the peak of that, with actors like Robert Duvall and Dustin Hoffman, everybody supporting me in the movie, they would not support it. Once I made the movie independently with the help of private equity, by the way, Mr. Bose, I will be approaching you for some if you want some venture capital, I got an idea for you. And you'll have the great, I don't know if it will be the privilege, but you'll have the honor of being the only person that would be interested in the movie. But I found one of those people, and he believed in me and the film, and through that support and my $9 million and shot in 35 days and prepped in 4 weeks, which is insane for a movie which is a period piece set in Cuba with not being able to go to Cuba to shoot it. We made the movie. We started approaching major festivals around the world to show the movie. The first one we approached was Toronto Film Festival. I get a word back from the distributor, who was a foreign distributor, saying, they called, they said, the movie, halfway through the movie, they thought the movie would open the festival. Then once the movie was over, it was a pass. And I go, we went from opening the festival to a pass in the context of 2 hours? And I said, oh, I see the first half of the movie, it was the anti-Batista rebellion. And the second half of the movie was Fidel Castro's betrayal of his own revolution. Oh, I see, I get it now. And it began like that. Festivals all around the world began to pass on the film. Festivals that I had been with many other movies. And there was one gentleman who did not pass. And he's here tonight, Mr. Tom Luddy from the Telluride. And he honored us with the opening night of the Telluride Film Festival and a tribute to Cabrera Infante, who had passed away. And we showed the movie, I believe it was 6 times, which I think, Tom, if you correct me, was maybe like a record in the festival, correct? Because of the demand that you were able to, if people want to see the movie, they'll keep screening it. And we ended up having to show the movie 6 times. Every major distributor in the American film business, you know, and here was there. But no one bought the film. There wasn't one Cuban at the festival. Well, there was about 10 Cubans, the members of my cast who went. But other than that, it was an American cinephile audience, mostly, I would say, liberal. Everybody loved the movie, but yet no distributor would jump on the film. One woman from Magnolia Pictures, who was in their HD network, saw it and says, I would like to, I love this movie. I want to talk to Mark Cuban and his company. And there was the only little bite that came out of the festival, and slowly we pursued it. It was the only distributor that was willing to stand behind the film. The film now has been seen all over the world, and it has been seen in Cuba clandestinely. There's been pirated as DVDs all through Cuba because I get a lot of feedback about that. But again, I said to David, and this is the curious thing that I learned. Once the movie came out, and this is, I think it's important in America and for all of us, and I don't mean to go on because I'm probably taking too long here, and I'm so honored to be in the same company of William and Bishop Tutu, and I don't want to take any more time, but I really felt that as the movie came out, I realized that because I've shown the movie so much to people who have no issues about Cuba and find the movie to be completely, just like any other movie, well-balanced, and it's a movie, it's a historical picture like Schindler's List would be. There was a very curious thing for me because I had never experienced that kind of deep animosity towards my work in a way. And I just got back from Cuba. I just got back from Cuba, and I was there at the party about half an hour ago. And I just got back from Italy 3 days, 2 days ago, and I was doing some interviews there. And again, I found myself in a position where trying to educate people of what's going on, because truly people do not know either the history of Cuba, what went on in Cuba, or what's going on in Cuba right now. And they're still being somehow fed this sort of false information. And so I celebrate the Independent Institute providing a forum for that type of education, because ultimately there are societies and countries all around the world that we need to know what's going on. And as Jose Marti said, you know, liberty is something that you must be able to sacrifice your life for. And for those of us who have had liberty taken away from us, we know its true value. And I thank, as a proud American, the opportunity to pursue my dreams and speak my voice, which is why my parents brought me here. Thank you.
back to your
table.
Thank you so much, Andy. Thank you sincerely, Andy. Our third course will now begin. Our third honoree, Desmond Tutu, is Archbishop Emeritus of Cape Town and former head of the Anglican Church of South Africa. He is the world-renowned Nobel Peace Prize laureate, who earlier as chairman of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, brought a peaceful settlement to the end of apartheid, and today is a tireless champion of freedom, human rights, and peace. Here's a video of remarks by Archbishop Tutu on the experience of South Africa, taken from programs by NTSC and the Charlie Rose Program.
I suppose that human beings looking at it would say that arms are the most dangerous things that a dictator, a tyrant needs to fear. But in fact, no. It is when people decide they want to be free. Once they have made up that, their minds to that, there's nothing that will stop them.
There is no hope for any relationship which has broken down unless someone of the contending parties says sorry and the other is willing to forgive. There is no future if there has been a breakdown and there is no forgiveness. It wasn't the prosecution that was having to try to prove something. It was the perpetrator telling us from their own mouth, the horse's mouth, this is in fact what we did. So we got the truth from them. We got the truth in some of the most heart-rending instances where people had been abducted and buried secretly. And no one had known what happened. And we were able to go and exhume. On one occasion, they went and they opened a grave. And a young man, whose brother it was, says, "Ah, yes, that is my brother. I bought him those shoes. We acknowledge some horrible things have happened to you. We give you the opportunity to tell your story, a story that for so long has remained untold, to give you a voice so that you are no longer a voiceless, anonymous nonentity. We hope that this telling will assist in the rehabilitation of your dignity." And many of those who came forward attested to the fact that just the telling had somehow helped them. Very, very humbling. Very humbling. Listening to people who had been grievously, they were hurt, treated in an abominable fashion, and you expecting them to spew forth anger and resentment and a lust for vengeance, nothing of the sort. They come along and they amaze you with their magnanimity. If you torture, that is a gross violation of human rights, whether you are liberation movement or apartheid government. Torture is torture. But it was the taking responsibility, the being accountable, because You can't say it is aberrations when a cabinet minister says his predecessor, state president, gave him orders to blow up a building in a very busy part of Johannesburg, knowing that there was a very great risk of people being killed, so that it is, in fact, attempted murder, attempted killing, which is in the act, it is defined as a gross violation of human rights to attempt any of these things. The world actually recognizes goodness when it sees it. And this is what gives me this thrill about this new millennium. That, yes, awful things have happened, but also some very good things have happened. And the last word that can be spoken about us is not about our capacity for evil. It's about our capacity for good, for generosity, for gentleness, for love.
I'm very pleased to present our next speaker. Born in Ghana, Georgia Yiddy is distinguished economist in residence in the Department of Economics at American University in Washington and president of the Free Africa Foundation. His many books include Africa Unchained, Africa in Chaos, The Blueprint for Ghana's Economic Recovery, Africa Betrayed, and Indigenous African Institutions. Professor Yiddy.
Well, first of all, let me thank the Independent Institute for organizing this event. And I think you all agree that this event is real worth it and that the Independent Institute needs to be supported for this. And I have a confession to make, and that is, I was going to begin this speech with a little joke, but after listening to Andy Garcia and his emotional presentation, I thought liberty is not an issue that you joke around with. If you have suffered oppression, you really understand what it is to be free. So I canceled the joke that I was going to tell. It wasn't funny anyways. But I am very, very and profoundly honored to be paying a tribute to a great man, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, whom I have profoundly admired, and I've always taken to be my hero. And as many of you know, in the pantheon of great African liberation heroes, Archbishop Desmond Tutu stands tall and unique. And many of you know and associate his work with the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. But there's far more to this great man than just the struggle against apartheid. And I'll get to that in a minute. Now, born in 1931 in Klerksdorp, Transvaal, he was ordained as a priest in 1960. Then he went to Britain to study theology and returned to South Africa, and there he became the Secretary General of the South African Council of Churches in the early 1970s. Now, he burst into the political scene after the Soweto riots in 1976. And the riots were provoked by an attempt by the racist National Party's government to use the Afrikaans as the main compulsory medium of education in black schools. Archbishop Desmond Tutu rallied world public opinion against oppression in South Africa. And it is important to notice that during this particular time, the ANC was in exile, and Nelson Mandela was in prison. So Archbishop Desmond Tutu, in effect, was the Lone Ranger, the lone black African voice with moral authority against the struggle against apartheid. I mean, he vigorously challenged the constructive engagement policies of the Reagan administration and advocated for disinvestment against South Africa. A lot of people criticized him and saying that, well, look, sanctions against South Africa will hurt the black people. And they said, well, at least even if it hurts the black people, they will be suffering with a purpose. Now, for comparing apartheid to Nazism and communism, his passport was twice revoked and he himself thrown into prison briefly in 1980. But the world paid attention to his struggles and rewarded him with a Nobel Peace Prize in 1984. 2 years later, he became he assumed the presidency of the All Africa Conference of Churches. And this provided him with a platform to launch the campaign against apartheid from African capitals, which culminated in the formation of the frontline states against apartheid in South Africa. Then he was also able to organize more than 3,000 people in protests in Cape Town, which within months brought about the release of Nelson Mandela. And as you all know, elections were subsequently held. The ANC won those elections. Nelson Mandela became the president of South Africa, and he appointed Archbishop Desmond Tutu to chair the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. Now, dear Archbishop Desmond Tutu, for your courageous fight against oppression and injustice, we salute you. We are very much proud of you, and I am one of those who have followed you, and there are also many of us who are sincerely following your footsteps to advance your cause, and would like to assure you that we'll carry your cross much farther. Mr. Chairman, dignitaries, ladies and gentlemen, as I said in the beginning, there's far more to Archbishop Desmond Tutu than this very incomplete biographical sketch indicates. His great contribution to African liberation transcends South Africa. He was the only one of the great African heroes. He was the only one who recognized that oppression is oppression, regardless of the skin color, the ideology, the sex or religion of the oppressor. He was the only one. To you, it might sound obvious that this is how it should be. But that wasn't the case in post-colonial Africa. Because much of the world, and I could relate to Garcia's point, in much of the world defined freedom in racialist terms. In the world, especially in the Western world, it was often assumed that, well, because Africans, put an end to colonial rule, okay, Africans must be free. I mean, you and I know that is patently false. Fact of the matter is, true freedom never came to Africa, much of Africa. You see, what we did in Africa was that we traded one set of masters for another set. We traded white colonialists for black new colonialists. And the oppression and the exploitation of the African people went on unabated. That wasn't true freedom. As a matter of fact, independence was in name only. Now, in the West, you couldn't say this. because political correctness stood in the way. You couldn't condemn the atrocities of black African leaders because if you did so, if you were a white person, you were called a racist. And African Americans also shied away from criticizing black African leaders because they wanted to express racial solidarity with them. So nobody would touch black oppression in Africa. And in Africa, we couldn't also criticize the oppression of black African leaders against their own people. Why? Because their leaders were afflicted with what I call intellectual astigmatism. They could see with eagle-eyed clarity the oppression perpetrated against black people by the whites, but they were hopelessly blind to the atrocities and the injustices meted out against black people by their own black African leaders. Now, this double standard was what is called the ruination of post-colonial Africa. It's an abominable double standard. When Idi Amin was butchering Ugandans at the rate of 100 per day, nobody lifted a finger to condemn it. The world kept quiet. Had that many African giraffes been slaughtered, you could have imagined the uproar in the whole world. Now, this double standard is still preventing black African leaders to criticize the abomination that we have in Zimbabwe today. Why aren't they criticizing Mugabe? Two reasons. The first, they want to express there is an African solidarity which says that it is a taboo for one African leader to criticize another. Okay. Then there is a second reason. The second reason is that these leaders themselves are doing exactly the same thing against their own black people in their own black African countries. So who are they to criticize Mugabe? Out of the 54 African countries, only 16 of them are democratic. So who are they to promote democracy in Africa? Now, this is the hypocrisy, and it is a painful truth. Hypocrisy which has been raging across Africa. These were the leaders who were marching down to South Africa to demand one man, one vote, which the blacks there should have. But they themselves had instituted in their own countries de facto apartheid regimes in their own countries against South Africa, against their own black people. Archbishop Desmond Tutu saw this hypocrisy and railed against it. May God bless him. Apartheid, by definition, or in essence, means that it is a system of governance. It means exclusion. Exclusion or separation. It's a system of government where a group has monopolized both economic and political power and uses that to advance their interests to the total exclusion of everybody else. Now, well, let me tell you something. I got news for you. This was exactly the same type of governance we had the rest of Africa. In South Africa, it was the whites who monopolized political and economic power to advance their interests and excluded blacks. We all knew that. In Sudan and Mauritania, it was the Arabs who monopolized both economic and political power, used that to advance their interests and exclude the blacks. In Rwanda and Burundi, it was the Hutus and Tutsis who monopolized political power, and they practiced tribal apartheid. Elsewhere in Africa, it was one political party which monopolized political and economic power and used that to advance their interests under the one-party state systems. Then we had the group being military, which monopolized economic and political power, used that to advance their interests. The military generals, for example. And notice this, the military has been the scourge of Africa. All these countries that have imploded in recent years in Africa were all ruled by military generals. Rwanda, military general, Juvenal Habyarimana. Somalia imploded in 1991. General Siad Barre, Burundi, General Pierre Buyoya, Zaire General Mobutu Sese Seko, Liberia General Samuel Doe, Sierra Leone General Joseph Momoi, Togo General Eyadema. You can go down the list. Of these countries which have been ruled by military generals, let's not talk about Nigeria, which is just, you know, military generals have reduced the once promising giant of Africa to a midget. Now, Archbishop Desmond Tutu was one of the very, very few, he's an exception, who recognized that the political systems that were established in post-colonial Africa were far more tyrannical than the colonial, hated colonial systems that we had. But of course, he couldn't say this. But for his courage in saying this, you know, shed a light for many of us. And it was for this reason that I dedicated my first book, Africa Betrayed, to him. And I quoted him extensively in my book. And I'd like to read you a few of these quotes, because the few of these quotes provide insights to the sort of the political systems, the oppression and the tyranny we have suffered in post-colonial Africa. Now, first of all, let me read you this. At the Nairobi Africa Conference of Churches in December 1987, okay, Archbishop Desmond Tutu said that it is sad that South Africa is noted for its vicious violations of human rights, but it is also very sad to know that in many black African countries today, there is less freedom than there was during that much maligned colonial period. This is what he said in 1987. Now, he repeated the same statement a year later at the All Saints Cathedral in March of 1990. He lamented the fact that there was even more freedom during the much maligned colonial period than in many African countries today. He said this: It is true that God's children in Africa suffer because there have been less freedom in their countries than during the month of colonial periods. And African leaders need to be reminded that there is totalitarianism and despotism nearly everywhere in Africa. And he reminded them that when your people are free, then you can also walk freely, and you will not need huge security to protect you. That's what Archbishop Desmond Tutu said in 1919. Now, he's also railed against the suppression of freedom of expression. And he said this, please listen carefully. And in a speech to Oxford University in 1990, he said this: "I should confess to our shame that on the whole, when we in modern Africa have not been able to accommodate differences of opinion, when you differ from somebody, if you don't agree four square with every point of view, then this is taken to mean that you are the enemy." But this is not how it is in traditional Africa. In traditional Africa, a chief was a good chief because he was able to work out a consensus. And that consensus were arrived because people had different points of opinion. And I have to confess that there is fundamental weakness that we have at this present time. In other words, and you see, this is still true. Still, out of the 54 African countries, only 8 of them, okay, have an independent and free media. Now, this is the type of struggle that we need to continue in Africa. In Africa, we need to promote further not just political freedom, but also intellectual freedom and economic freedom. And I'd like to assure the great African hero, my great African hero, that he should rest assured that we will continue with the struggle to make Africa totally free. Thank you very much.
Archbishop Tutu, when others had little or no vision, integrity, and hope, you stood virtually alone for truth, liberty, reconciliation, and peace. Your leadership provided the courage, inspiration, stability, and harmony that was needed among people who were brutalized and consumed by fear. And it's indeed an honor for us to have you with us, to present you with the Alexis de Tocqueville Award.
Thank you so very much, Mr. President and George. Professor George. Thank you. I was warned to be relatively brief. And I usually tell people, you must be looking for a miracle. You have a preacher at a podium with a captive audience. And you expect what? I've told the story of this preacher who went on for a very long time. At last he said, "What more can I say?" And somebody at the back of the church said, "Amen." Thank you so very much for this great and prestigious award that you have given me. And may I congratulate my fellow honorees. It's wonderful to stand in their reflected glory. I normally say that awards of this kind I receive in a representative capacity. Professor Ite said some wonderful things, but he would be the first to admit that, you know, when you are in a crowd and you stand out in that crowd, it is only really because you are being carried on the shoulders of others. That there were very many of us who risked many things. But in fact, I and my family did not suffer as much as so many others did. I spent only one night in jail. When you compare that to, say, 27 years, it's piffling. And when you think of the many who were tortured, many who had to go into exile, many who were killed brutally. Yes, I was very greatly blessed. But I often say that I was a leader at that time, really by default, because our leaders were either in jail or in exile or had been restricted in one way or another. But don't go away with the idea that, oh, isn't he nice? He's so modest. He's nothing of the sort. I visited West Point Military Academy with my wife on one occasion, and at the end of the visit, the cadets gave me a cap to commemorate the visit, and I tried the cap on, and it didn't fit. A nice wife would have said, the cap is small. My wife said, his head is too big. Just perhaps one or two thoughts about all of us. That we have a world that has been hag-ridden by conflict. And a great deal of that is when people are retaliating or think they are retaliating. I mean, you think of what happened in Bosnia, that they're fighting or were fighting about something that happened several centuries ago, but it's become part of their history. When you, Professor George referred to Rwanda, and you think there that actually, as I told them, I had the privilege of preaching soon after the genocide in Kigali. The new government invited me to come and preach, and I said their history in many ways was very easy to illustrate because it was a history of top dog and underdog. At one time, the Hutu would be the top dog and the one would be, the Tutsis would be the underdogs. The underdog wants to be top dog, and when the previous underdog becomes top dog, they pay back for what they imagine, either what happened to them or what they imagined happened to them. And you have that cycle almost inexorable. And you know what happened in Northern Ireland until recently. The Roman Catholics and the Protestants. We were incredibly blessed in South Africa to have had, at a crucial time in our history, this extraordinary man, Nelson Mandela, who, by the way, was not a magnanimous, compassionate person when he went to jail. He was young. And the 27 years that many of us reckon is a waste of time was the 27 years were quite important in the evolution of a Nelson Mandela from being, if you remember, he was the commander-in-chief of the military wing of the ANC. And it was in jail with all of the suffering. What suffering either makes you bitter or it ennobles you. But we were very lucky that he was at the helm of our ship of state, and where people had expected an orgy of revenge and retribution, I think people, to some extent, were awed by the spectacle of our Truth and Reconciliation Commission. By the way, we didn't invent Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They had happened in other countries. But perhaps the fact that ours had at least two novel features. The one was that all of its proceedings were public. And second, that it was the first commission that could grant amnesty to perpetrators. Well, it was quite clear that had we sought to follow the path of retributive justice, we would not be standing here, as it were, celebrating a South Africa that has become free and democratic. Because all that would have done would have been to provoke this cycle that we have seen. You see it in the Middle East. You know as sure as anything that you will have a suicide bomber do something in Israel, and you know you don't have to have a degree, as they say, in rocket science, that is going to be a reprisal. And there will be a reaction one day to that reprisal. And it just goes on and on and on. And when peace comes, don't we always ask, but why were we so stupid for so long? Because, as someone was saying to me, everyone knows what peace is going to look like in the Middle East. And you say, but then why should we have so many deaths now, between now and then? I want to stop. Because I think one of the videos, as it were, stole my thunder. imagine that you have not seen it. And I know that you're all very nice people. You know, I had thought that what I was going to take away, or most of us would take away from a 2-3 year experience of listening to harrowing testimony, was this desperately traumatizing thought, how awful human beings can be. We have this extraordinary capacity for evil. You know, I mean, when you think, I mean, someone can come and testify and say, we gave him drugged coffee, we shot him in the head, and we burnt his body. And it takes maybe 8 hours for a human body to burn. And whilst we were watching his body burn, we were having a barbecue, drinking beer and burning two kinds of flesh. And you say, what could have happened to the humanity of people who could sink to such low levels? And you realized, yes, actually it speaks about each one of us, that each one of us has the capacity even for that kind of evil. We may, all we can say is, there but for the grace of God go I. Because none of us could ever predict what we could do. Because, I mean, the people who were involved in the Holocaust, who could throw babies into gas chambers and ovens, didn't have horns, didn't have tails. They were just ordinary human beings like you and me. They went to church. And the people who used to torture, who were part of death squads in South Africa, well, they were often respectable members of the community. So, yes, we each have this incredible capacity. But that was not what one took away. I mean, I marvel. I marvel that what I have taken away, and I think my colleagues have taken away, is an exhilarating awareness. It's quite surprising what you take away. What we've taken away is the fact that people can be so magnanimous, so incredibly generous. People who by rights should have been consumed by bitterness and were almost lusting for revenge, doing nothing of the sort. I mean, many, many times I used to say, after we listened to the testimony of a victim, I would say, let us keep quiet, for we are in the presence of the holy. We ought to take off our shoes, for we're standing on holy ground. It was incredible. It gave you goose pimples. But it is what it says about you, that you have an incredible capacity for good. Let me just tell you one story and then I will sit down. We were given, three of us were asked to be a panel in Northern Ireland. One was a professor from Harvard, Professor Hicks, Donna Hicks. And another was a Scottish woman who had married a Rwandese who had been killed in the genocide. And the three of us were part of a BBC program series, Facing the Truth. And we had something akin to a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Northern Ireland. And it was extraordinary that the people came, whereas there was nothing that we were going to get for perpetrators. There was no amnesty. In fact, one of the people who came had already served 30 years in jail. And the victims would get nothing. But they came. They came. And I want to tell you the story of one police officer who lost both arms in an IRA bomb outrage. He came with his family, and the IRA man sat over there. And the IRA described his life, described how he'd been born into a ghetto because of the discrimination against Roman Catholics that happened there. Described the deprivation that he had experienced, and then finished. And we waited with some apprehension for the response of this man who had lost both arms. He kept quiet for a while. And then he looked the IRA man in the eyes and said, "If I had had your experience, if I had lived as you had lived, I think I would have done what you did." Speaking about blowing off his hands, his arms. That's what you are. That incredibly, we, you and I, are made for goodness. And when we see the extent of evil there is in the world, we almost forget that. We're made for goodness. We're made for generosity. We're made for laughter. We're made for sharing. That's what we're made for. Did you hear of who had the chickens in his backyard? And then one day he goes and he checks out on the chickens and he sees a strange-looking chicken. It looks like the other chickens, but it doesn't quite look like the other chickens. And then a very smart visitor passes by and says to the farmer, "Oh man, no, that's no chicken. That's an eagle." And the farmer says, "Ah, it looks like other chickens. I mean, it keeps walking about and picking." And so this traveler says, "Give it to me." And the farmer gives him this strange-looking chicken. And this guy walks up and goes to the top of a mountain and waits for the sun to rise. And the sun rises. And he says to the strange looking chicken, "Fly eagle fly. And this strange-looking chicken shakes itself and spreads out its pinions and lifts off and flies away into the distance towards the rising sun. You know something? God says to us, hey, you're no chicken. You're an eagle. Fly, eagle, fly. And God wants us to shake ourselves, spread out our pinions, and lift off and soar and soar and soar towards transcendence, goodness, beauty, truth, laughter, joy. Fly, eagle, fly. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining with us. We hope that we'll see you again at upcoming Institute events. Good night.